to session 8 of Depression and Anxiety Recovery Program. First of all, I'd like to congratulate you on the positive changes you've already made in your life in the last 7 weeks. Change is hard, and you have done the work necessary to the extent that you have changed. But I would also like you to think about changes that were recommended to optimize your brain that you haven't put into practice yet. You will be taking the Depression and Anxiety Assessment Test and seeing how it compares with the first test. But in general, how many changes you've made is going to very much correlate with what your new scores are. And you can continue to improve as you make more positive changes that will be healthy for your brain. Today, we're going to be looking at making and staying with positive lifestyle choices. And this session has a lot of bearing in regards to how well you're going to be doing at 20 weeks. Because we not only want to make those changes, we want to stay with them. And these can be lifelong changes that can benefit us from here until the rest of our life. Whether you're a rock star or a sports hero or a scientist or a doctor or a nurse or a government worker or a teacher, whatever your profession, if you're a student, you name it, anyone wants to live the good life. I don't know of anyone who doesn't have that desire to live the good life. And our goal is not to just have you depression-free and anxiety-free, but fulfilled. And as a result of attending this session today, you are going to have a door open to you for the great life, not just the good life. Many people think they know how to experience the good life, and they will pursue something that is a false fantasy. They'll achieve what they thought was going to bring them the good life. It might be more money, but money does not buy happiness once our basic needs are there. And they can have all sorts of significant disappointments even though they have more money. And so we want to get to the real solution of living the good life. And it will also give you the solution to live depression-free and anxiety-free in the future from here on out. So when we introduced you to the causes of depression and anxiety, we mentioned there were over 100 of them, and they can be categorized into 10 different ways. Briefly going through there's genetic hits, developmental hits, adverse childhood experiences, lifestyle hits. This is something we can do something about by getting you on a good physical fitness program. And hopefully you are there already. If not, you still have some opportunity to get more fit. But physical fitness is better for your brain than it is your body. And we really want to emphasize getting rid of this lifestyle hit. It's reversible. Circadian rhythm hits. This is your sleep-wake cycle. Hopefully you're on a regular schedule, early to bed, early to rise, not using screens for an hour before going to bed, using that light therapy and benefiting in your brain chemistry by more serotonin and more melatonin at night. Nutrition hits. Hopefully you have changed your diet to be more optimal, more antioxidants, more tryptophan and tyrosine into the brain, more nutrients that can help us produce those neurotransmitters. Hopefully you're staying away from toxins. And hopefully you're doing the cognitive behavioral therapy to improve your social relations and that you are using the tools that we have explained in regards to coping with stress and with the significant losses in your life. If you've had an addiction, this is a good time to give it up. And I'm going to really encourage you to give it an honest try and try to make a clean break with things that are addictive and harmful to you. And then there are things like medical conditions that we may not necessarily be able to do a lot about, but we do need to see physicians and see if we can correct the medical conditions that can be associated. And then there are frontal lobe hits This is the spiritual part of the brain, and it's also the analytical part of the brain and the decision-making portion of the brain. So just a review, our brain's pretty resilient, but once we get to four hits, that's when depression, anxiety, or another mental illness comes about. And some people have more leeway than others. For instance, if you have a genetic hit, a developmental hit, and a medical hit that you can't do anything about, how much leeway do you have before you go into depression? You're only going to have one other hit. And so this is why we have some individuals that they have to be very particular at staying on the program. If they start losing sleep, if they start indulging in a bad diet, if they quit their exercise program, if they quit their light, it's going to be enough to tip them over the edge. And then there are some people that don't have any genetic mutations. They haven't had any adverse childhood experiences. They don't have any medical conditions. And it looks like they're getting by because they don't have depression and they don't even exercise. And they're not necessarily on a good diet. And of course, that can be discouraging to some. Wait a minute, I thought this was diet and lifestyle related, and this person's on a bad diet and a bad lifestyle, but they don't have depression. Well, they may not have any of those other hits, but they will end up with depression. Even if they don't have any genetic, developmental, or medical conditions, they will end up with depression if they have four of those hits. And as you can see, seven of those 10 categories are completely reversible. And that's the good news. So let's get into some of the ones that don't seem to be as reversible, like genetic hits. We can't have you go back and be conceived again so that you don't have that genetic mutation. But interestingly, genetics loads the gun and lifestyle pulls the trigger. That's why genetic hit by itself is never enough to cause depression. But the good news is, one of the most common genetic hits, and we measure people when they come through our residential program, is something called undermethylation. And undermethylators have more trouble making three different neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine. We have found that if we put them on the right nutrients, we can totally deactivate that mutated gene. It's like it's not even there. And that mutated gene is associated with obsessive compulsive disorder. It's associated with a higher tendency to have addictions. And so we can help the brain chemistry significantly just through nutrition and lifestyle measures. What about if you have a developmental hit and if you've had these adverse childhood experiences? We can figure out what it was. There might be an attachment disorder because of the way you were raised. You might have an anxious attachment disorder. You might have other attachment issues because of abuse or trauma. And we can find out which areas you have a tendency to have significant thinking errors because of this. And that, as we work on that, those thinking errors and practicing that, we can actually reverse the effects of the adverse childhood experiences. And so even that can be helped to a large degree. Medical conditions sometimes can be helped as well. If it's a thyroid condition, we can actually give you prescription thyroid medicine to replace the thyroid that you don't have. And that can deactivate that hit. If it's a head concussion, we may need to have you on extra omega-3 to help you combat the effects of traumatic brain injury in your life. You might need more infrared, as we talked about, for traumatic brain injury. If it's an autoimmune disease, we are going to be very particular in getting you more omega-3 and not having any arachidonic acid so you don't have that inflammation, because depression and anxiety is often an inflammatory disease of the brain. Why am I saying this? Because sometimes people are fatalistic. I have these three hits and there's nothing I can do. But often nutrition and lifestyle measures can even help those hits. And the other seven, it's very clear that just by putting this education into practice, we can get rid of those hits. And the less hits we have, the greater our brain is optimized and the more fulfillment we can experience. What about if you have Lyme disease? What if you have hepatitis C? Interestingly, we have done studies on our patients with hepatitis C and chronic infections, and we find out that they also significantly improve just from this community mental health education program. We've actually published that. A medical hit might be vitamin D deficiency. Well, with that, we just need to get you more vitamin D. We talked about some of these other things. I mentioned stroke, I think, earlier, but our study showed that even 90% of stroke patients that come through our program have significant improvement in their depression and anxiety because we've optimized the other portions of their brain to take over some of those functions from the stroke. Uncontrolled blood pressure can also respond to lifestyle measures, and then some things not as readily, like terminal cancer or Parkinson's disease, so we still may end up with those hits being there, but fortunately the brain is resilient enough. Uncontrolled diabetes, that can be controlled through nutrition and lifestyle measures most commonly. Long-term COVID can actually be controlled in many ways through nutrition and lifestyle measures. And then even congestive heart failure by being very particular about your sodium intake and cholesterol intake. And severe postpartum stress can also be helped with things like light therapy. And these are all medical hits that we often thought we couldn't do much about, but even these things can be treated, including inadequately treated adrenal gland disease. So I wanted you to understand that in some of these cases, it might be good to see a medical health specialist that can put you on that designer approach to help with some of these medical conditions that you have, or maybe genetic conditions if they're very good in understanding epigenetics. But let's go back to our title, Making and Staying with Positive Lifestyle Choices. And we're going to break down the stages of change, some of these you've been going through, into four stages. The first stage is to be unconsciously incompetent. What does that mean? You haven't even contemplated making any changes because you don't know what you're putting into your body and what you're doing to your body is harmful, but it's still hurting you. And that's why it says that you are unconsciously incompetent. How can we go to the next stage? The next stage is actually to become consciously incompetent. We go to the next stage by good scientific information. We call it education. And you've been getting education here. You've been getting good science that's been backed up by well-designed studies. And as a result, many of you have gone from unconsciously incompetent to consciously incompetent. What does that make you do? That makes you contemplate whether it might be worthwhile for you to change. And you might even recognize, I think it would be beneficial, and so I'm going to prepare to make these changes in my life. Once you do make the changes in your life, you're no longer consciously incompetent, you're now consciously competent. Now, let me give you an example of one of our therapists, actually, that has helped out in our residential program. One of our therapists did not realize until she heard good scientific information that she was ingesting something that was not best for her. Whenever she got thirsty, she would not drink water. Her beverage of choice was Pepsi. And so whenever she got thirsty, she thought about Pepsi, she got a Pepsi, she drank it. And this would happen multiple times throughout the day. Well, Pepsi has something that actually can increase irritability. It suppresses the frontal lobe a little bit. She was having increased irritability in her life. And she was also having a gastrointestinal issue called reflux. Caffeine relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter and allows acid to come up. And she was having to take antacids and Tums and medicine for this. And so when she learned about this, she decided, I am irritable with my husband, which I love. He's getting irritated by it. Maybe I should change. So she decided she was going to give up Pepsi. She went from consciously incompetent to consciously competent. And now when she was thirsty, What do you think she was thinking about? She was still thinking about Pepsi. But then she would say, no, not Pepsi. I'm going to drink water. Next time she got thirsty, what do you think she thought about? Pepsi again. She said, no, not Pepsi. I'm going to drink water. See, she was consciously competent because it had to be in her consciousness. Whenever this feeling of a need of Pepsi came, she had to be conscious and say, no, not Pepsi, it's going to be water. But then she noticed something. 2 to 3 weeks after no caffeine and only water, her irritability went away and her reflux went away. But it took 30 days before, when she was thirsty, she was now thinking of water. She didn't even think of Pepsi, and she was now enjoying the taste of water. She didn't like water beforehand. And now she was actually very glad to receive that water. And it was even more refreshing than the Pepsi was. And about a year later, now as a result, once you're in that stage where you're not even thinking about your former way, not even wanting it, that's when you become unconsciously competent. In other words, it's no longer a struggle. A lot of people think they have to flip back and forth between stages 2 and 3, and it's going to be a lifelong struggle to give up the things that they used to like. But they don't realize that if you're persistent, you get here, and it's not a lifelong struggle. A year later, she was at a conference, and this was a conference that had no water. In the back of the room, it was only sodas. So she's looking at these sodas, she's very thirsty, she's going back there, she's thinking of water, and she didn't know where she could get water from unless she drove somewhere in the middle of this conference to go get some water. And so she thought, you know, I used to like Pepsi, it used to hydrate me, there's a Pepsi here, I'll go ahead and drink my Pepsi. And so she drank the Pepsi and she didn't even like it. She couldn't finish it. She says, it tastes like sugary battery acid. I can't believe I used to enjoy this stuff. It doesn't even taste good. And then she didn't like the feeling that it gave her afterwards. And that's a sign of an unconsciously competent individual. And she has stuck to that, never gone back to Pepsi since. So it takes 18 to 254 days for a person to form a new habit. Now, you've gone through 8 weeks, so some of those new habits, if you gave up caffeine earlier on, you might already be through that. You might already be at the unconsciously competent stage. But for the typical average habit, it takes 66 days for a new behavior to become automatic. It's worth pushing through those 66 days. We've talked about some habits that take even longer than that, but there's none that's above 254 days. And so as we press through for a year, any habit that we've had that's harmful, we can get to the unconsciously competent stage within less than a year. And you'll not only enjoy the benefits to your mental health, but you will also, of course, have benefits to your physical health. So to change your life, you must change your habits. And habits form much more than our schedules. They actually form over half of our waking hours. So they form our lives. Over half of our waking hours, we are participating in habits. And once they become good habits, that can help us greatly. Many people don't recognize that their chains of habit are too weak to feel until they're too strong to break. So when they start something that's a bad habit, they think, hey, I can break this at any time, not an issue, I can back away from it. But some habits are like chains of steel, and they seem to be too strong to break when we really need to give them up. In fact, I would suggest for those of you that have learned better ways to live your life in regards to your habits, but you haven't given it up yet, chances are the reason why is because you're feeling like you're chained, like you really can't do it, or it may not be worth it because of how hooked you are in regards to this. So, but this is why we have programs such as this one to help you break those bad habits. and not be broken otherwise as you improve your brain chemistry. So challenging hits can transform your life. Take active efforts to eliminate or reduce your mental health hits. And when the frontal lobe is enhanced, it's easier to recover from depression and anxiety and experience the good life. The secret to the psychological good life is comprehensive self-control. This is something that is different than selective self-control. What is self-control? It's our ability to keep ourselves from acting on our behavioral or emotional impulses. Self-control failure is central to nearly all the personal and social problems that currently plague citizens of the modern developed world. This is a statement by Roy Baumeister from Stanford, who tells us that self-control failure is the number one problem in all the world. It's even a worse problem than what all the politicians talk about. Yet I've never heard a single politician ever talk about this. The presidents don't talk about it. Congress doesn't talk about it. They talk about other problems that are big problems. But in reality, lack of self-control is a bigger problem in the world and in this country than they don't even discuss it. Maybe one of the reasons why it is such a big problem. Why is it the number one problem in all the world? Well, when we know how to eliminate heart disease through nutrition and lifestyle, and it's still the number one killer, this is a serious self-control problem. It's not a heart problem per se. It's a disease of the mind, a disease of the mind that we can all have, which is lack of self-control. And this kills thousands of individuals every day in America, and it's the number one cause of death throughout the world. And it is able to be reversed and eliminated, we already know, through nutrition and lifestyle. So that tells you right up, when the number one cause of death is a disease of lack of self-control, even the number two cause of death, I'll mention later, but it's cancer. Harvard says we can prevent 80% of cancers if we would put into practice good nutrition and lifestyle measures and give up smoking and alcohol and those sorts of things. And so 80% of cancers are actually due to lack of self-control once we know what's best for us. Diabetes is actually going up considerably. Diabetes, yes, genetics loads the gun, but it's lifestyle that pulls the trigger. And we know how to prevent diabetes if you have the gene for it, type 2 diabetes, that is. And we also know how to reverse that through nutrition and lifestyle measures. But it's skyrocketing because of lack of self-control. Sexually transmitted diseases have gone up considerably, even though obviously we know how to prevent those. Stroke, 80% of strokes can be prevented if we would put into practice what's best. Now, with stroke, it might just be taking your medicine. If you have a condition called atrial fibrillation, you have to take your blood thinners. Otherwise, that chamber that isn't working will get a clot in it. And so it sometimes as simple as just taking one medicine a day, but people won't have self-control to do that sometimes, and they'll end up with a stroke. Of course, hypertension is also a big cause of stroke. Alcoholism, by definition, lack of self-control. Murder rates have been going up considerably in our country. And most murders are actually just due to lack of being able to control your emotions. And then there's regret afterwards. Rape has been going up due to lack of self-control. Once you know the principles of mentally healthful living, if you recover from depression and anxiety and you end up having depression or anxiety again, it's going to be due to lack of self-control. This is why we want you to understand this secret. This is the door to the psychological good life, is comprehensive self-control. Unwanted pregnancies, by definition, lack of self-control. Adultery or divorce, often it's due to lack of self-control on one partner or both partners. That's the core issue. Underachievement. We accept people with high ACT scores and high GPAs in universities, and if they're not successful, it's going to be due to the fact that they don't have comprehensive self-control in their life. Financial failure, often due to lack of self-control. Relationship problems, so many relationship problems stem from lack of self-control. Technology addiction, the number one non-substance addiction in the world. People know it's harming them, but they don't know how to get away from it, or they're not doing the necessary steps to overcome this addiction that's adversely affecting their mind. Lack of self-control. So what's the solution? The secular psychologists have told us the solution to this is temperance. So temperance is moderation in things that are healthy and abstinence in things that are unhealthy. And strict temperance requires comprehensive self-control. Now, everybody has selective self-control, at least in one area. Now, I've met people that have come to our program, and they'll tell me, I have zero self-control in my life. And as I talk to them, I realize they are very particular about the soil that they plant their marijuana plant in. They make sure it's watered. They know how to harvest it on time and what to do with it. They have meticulous self-control when it comes to their marijuana plant, but in other areas of their life, they don't have self-control. And so everyone has meticulous self-control in a particular area. And probably the best example of someone who was seen to be very highly successful that only had selective self-control is the former governor of California. And as I go around the world and lecture, this governor is more well-known than even presidents that have come from California, like Ronald Reagan. What is his name? Arnold Schwarzenegger, yes. And Arnold Schwarzenegger, how did he become famous? Was it because he was governor? No. Bodybuilding. Does it take meticulous self-control to build up muscles like Arnold did? Oh yeah, you have to be at the gym when you don't want to be at the gym. You have to be undergoing pain when you don't want to have pain. You have to be eating the right nutrients. You have to be getting on the right protein schedule. You have to do all of these things, making sure you're staying well hydrated. There's a lot of different meticulous self-control measures that come together to build those big muscles. That's when he became Mr. Universe. That's when he was asked to be in Hollywood. And then in an area of his life where it was more important for him to have self-control, when his maid was cleaning his house, he lacked it. And he lost the love of his life due to not having comprehensive self-control. And he was not happy about this. By the way, his wife didn't know about it until I think the young man was 18 years old and coming over to Arnold's place, and then she finds out about it, and she's saying, "What?" And he says, "Please, I love you. I want you to stay with me." And she says, "You've betrayed me for all of these years, and I can't stay with you." And he made it very clear he would have rather stayed married to his wife than to have Mr. Universe and all of these other things. So he lost what was most important to him as a result of not having comprehensive self-control. This is why it's so much connected to the psychological good life. So the scientists that have been studying this say that in our endeavor to measure this class of strengths, we have found that among people in the mainstream developed world, strengths of temperance are infrequently endorsed and seldom praised. However, the strengths of temperance are very important, and they have a rich array of positive consequences for the what? The psychological good life. That's what we've been talking about. Everyone wants to live the good life. But the secular psychologists that have been studying this have been telling us the way to get there is temperance. So how do they know this? Because they've been studying it. And in order to study something, first you have to measure it. So to measure self-control, there's a little instrument that's used to have people answer honestly this self-control test. And I'll give you a few of these examples. Getting up in the morning is hard for me. If you say that, are you going to have high self-control or low self-control? You're going to have low self-control. So as I go through these statements, tell me if it's going to be high or low. And for those watching on video, you can say this out loud as well. I blurt out whatever is on my mind. That's low self-control. I have a hard time breaking bad habits. Low self-control. I do certain things that are bad for me if they are fun. Low self-control. I get carried away by my feelings. Low self-control. By the way, if you do that, that's called emotional reasoning. I do many things on the spur of the moment. Low self-control. I spend too much money. Low self-control. I keep everything neat. High self-control. I don't keep secrets very well. Low self-control. More questions. I have trouble saying no. Low self-control. I'm not easily discouraged. High self-control. I eat healthy foods. High self-control. Pleasure and fun sometimes keep me from getting work done. Low self-control. I have trouble concentrating. That's low. Sometimes I can't stop myself from doing something, even if I know it is wrong. That's low self-control. I'm able to work effectively towards long-term goals. That's high self-control. So that's not all of the questions, but you can get an idea of what they're measuring, and you can get this entire questionnaire online if you want to do research in certain areas to see if self-control is enhanced. But this is what they have found out in regards to giving this instrument to large groups of people and following them over time. High self-control people have better personality adjustment, higher self-worth, better at controlling their anger, fewer symptoms of obsessive-compulsive patterns, depression, anxiety, hostile anger, phobias, paranoia, and psychotic tendencies. You might wonder, obsessive-compulsive? I thought that's high self-control. Well, no, obsessive-compulsive is majoring in minor, so they have meticulous self-control in a certain area, but another area where it's more important for them to have self-control, they don't have control in their life. People with high self-control accept themselves as valuable, worthy individuals and are relatively able to sustain this favorable view of self. People with high self-control are more conscientious. They're more emotionally stable. They make better relationship partners. They get along better with other people. They're more accommodating, not less accommodating. The researchers thought high self-control people might be harder to get along with. Not true. They're actually more accommodating of others than low self-control people are of others. They report more satisfying relationships. They have better adjustment in their relationships. And in addition, they have better family cohesiveness, less interpersonal conflict, better perspective, and better empathy. They don't wallow in their own personal reactions to other people's problems. They have more secure interpersonal attachments. They manage money well, they spend less, and they save more. You can see why self-control opens the door to the psychological good life that everyone is wanting, but most don't know how to get there. But the studies go on. They've studied children. You can actually raise children to have better self-control. It's one of the goals of healthy parenting. And they found out children with better self-control excel academically, they thrive socially, they flourish physically as well. They also found that it's more predictive of life outcomes from family, socioeconomic class, and even general intelligence. In other words, a lot of times people think, well, they're successful because their parents were successful. And there's something much more important than being successful parents as to how the kids are going to turn out, and it has to do whether the kids, by age 11, have good self-control or not. And so that's far more important than being born into a family of wealthy parents and being born into a family with successful parents. And it underscores the need for parenting that encourages self-control and delay of what? Delay of gratification, which is part of self-control. Now, the scientists also have shown us this. In the course of daily life, in spite of their best efforts at self-control, people inevitably, and I think it's interesting the words that they use here, people inevitably sin and transgress, at least on rare occasion. I think this is generally true. I think we can all agree that this is generally true. Even high self-control people mess up. But what happens if you do mess up and are engaged in even going against your own values? People with high self-control, when they mess up, tend to take responsibility for their transgressions. Those with low self-control tend to cast blame outside of themselves or minimize the importance of the transgression. So when they mess up, they blame others or they say this is no big deal. However, when high self-control individuals mess up, they tend to focus on the effects of their behavior and in so doing tend to what? Make amends. In other words, they are willing to ask for forgiveness and also to correct the issues that they caused in regards to harm to others as a result of them messing up and try to make amends. And you know, my father told me growing up, there's two types of people that you'll find out, Neil. He says, those with 20 years experience and those with 1 year's experience 20 times over. In other words, they haven't learned. And people with high self-control become better people over time. So if you have that commitment to it and you're willing to make amends, every year you're going to become a better person. So what is the solution to this lack of self-control? Or how can a low self-control person go to a high self-control person? And you can imagine how important this is as far as the research is concerned. Most acts of self-control, we're told, involve overcoming some incipient response to the immediate situation in order to pursue some greater long-term benefit. Hence, the ability to transcend the immediate situation is crucial. Studies have shown people who live only in the present moment are unlikely to exhibit good self-control, whereas future-mindedness will facilitate self-regulation. So that means that you are able to look into the future, and that's why enhancing the frontal lobe, which we mentioned a couple of sessions ago, that helps us to predict more accurately the future and have hope, is an important part of regaining self-control or taking a low self-control person and putting them into a high self-control person. Now, Dr. Roy Bonmeister, that I mentioned earlier, has been studying bright lines at Stanford. He says bright lines are needed for self-control. And he says this, zero tolerance is a bright line, total abstinence with no exceptions anytime. He says if we draw a bright line for ourselves in regards to things that are harmful and say, I'm not going to deviate from this, it's a bright line, total abstinence, no exceptions anytime, it will help with self-control. And there are some things that you have learned here that you should have zero tolerance for in your own life from here on out. And I would encourage you to make that list for yourself. What are the things that you should have zero tolerance? You will never go higher than the standard that you set for yourself. And by putting that into practice, you will build self-control in other areas of your life as well, not just in that area. So assistance in self-control. Bright lines. Worthy goals. And some people that come to our program, they'll tell me, I have no goals. But that's an unnatural state to be in. And my follow-up question on that is, what did your goals used to be before you thought you could not obtain them? Because they did have goals. Everyone has goals earlier in life. But now they think they can't obtain them. And often they couldn't obtain them because they don't have self-control to be able to do that. And so then they'll start talking about what their goals used to be. But the good news is what you thought was unobtainable before, once you incorporate this program, you'll find it very obtainable. I know of one person in particular who told me that very thing because he wanted to be a nurse, he wanted to help people, and he couldn't get into nursing school. And of course, he was into marijuana and other ways of self-sabotaging his brain. And as a result of going through this program, he was able to take pre-nursing after the program, get high grades, get into nursing school, and now he's an exceptional top nurse in an ICU in a facility here in America. And this was a worthy goal that he was able to go back to as a result of regaining self-control. Enhancing the frontal lobe, as I mentioned earlier, is helpful as well. How can we enhance the frontal lobe function? Engaging in analytical thinking, working with your hands in three dimensions on a regular basis, analyzing and enjoying melodious music that fits those principles we mentioned earlier, contemplating or creating proverbs. This helps with abstract thinking, slowing down the limbic system in overdrive. That means getting rid of the entertainment television and the YouTube and some of these dopamine surges that we talked about earlier, and reading, analyzing, and comparing spiritual themes. The frontal lobe is that spiritual aspect of the body, and we can't really ignore this aspect. What is spirituality? It's the quality of being concerned with the human spirit or soul as opposed to just material or physical things. Evidence in the field of spirituality and health clearly shows a relationship between spirituality, religiousness, and a decrease in the incidence of numerous psychiatric disorders. These disorders include depression, suicide, substance use, eating disorders, and even PTSD. As a result of this research, mental health providers should include questions relevant to patients' spiritual and religiousness in order to provide more comprehensive patient-centered care. The Joint Commission, which reviews hospitals and all the hospital accreditation things that are actually also government-driven, all require a spiritual inventory as a result of this because they recognize the science in regards to spirituality. So what I've just mentioned to you is really not debatable since the studies are so clear documenting what is stated here. And government organizations are very particular about us obtaining a spiritual inventory if we want to work on improving a person's mental health. One of the studies, among many, showed that strong religious faith helps speed recovery from depression. Depressed patients with higher intrinsic religiosity scores, that means they're not only going through the practice of it, but they're actually believing it, it's affecting their belief, had more rapid remissions than patients with lower scores. Patients recovered from depression 70% sooner with every 10-point increase in the religiosity assessment score. And I know we want to recover sooner, but again, this is the aspect in regards to improving frontal lobe function and having that commitment to strong religious faith. External religious activity also has some benefits. Scientific research shows a strong relationship between regular church attendance and higher life satisfaction, stronger marriages, and higher ratings of general health status. There's a correlation between low church attendance and depression among young people in particular. And interestingly, this study showed suicide rates significantly less among church attenders. By the way, there aren't medications that lower this risk. If there were, it would be almost malpractice not to prescribe it to someone who was thinking about ending their life. But this is something that does lower the suicide risk. And again, probably due to that effect on the frontal lobe of the brain. Deaths of despair have been increasing greatly in our country. These are deaths due to suicide, alcohol, and drug overdose, 3 times less likely among regular church attenders. Deaths of despair were decreasing our life expectancy in America for 3 or 4 years before even COVID hit. And life expectancy had always been going up in America, but with the rates of depression and anxiety going up, we're now seeing deaths of despair actually lower the average longevity age of Americans. And it's been continuing to go down since. And this is something that we can prevent. Also by enhancing the frontal lobe. Studies have shown suicide rates 3 to 16 times less likely among those who attend church weekly or more compared to those who never attend church. So a new way to look at mental health. A significant portion of what mental health institutions are working with is not actually mental health, but rather what? Mental illness or mental diseases. You know, they call themselves mental health centers, but they're actually mental disease centers. They're working with the disease. And there will always be problems that demand psychological solutions. So I'm not critical of that. But I think it's important for us to move beyond using only the disease model. And with our last session here today, I want you to think beyond just the disease model of depression and anxiety. And this is where we get into the area of positive psychology. Mental health is not only the absence of mental illness. It's the ability to flourish and thrive as you gain greater happiness and life purpose. And so you really don't have mental health just because you don't have mental disease. You want to flourish and thrive. And positive psychology emphasizes character strengths associated with thriving communities and individuals. The character traits that can be developed: courage, contentment or satisfaction, kindness, compassion, hope, and purpose. These are just some of the positive character strengths that are associated with a good mental health person. Under the category of courage, there's four different character strengths. One of them is bravery. Bravery is not the equivalent of fearlessness. It's the ability to do what needs to be done despite fear. And I would encourage you to embrace bravery. Do what needs to be done in your own life, despite the fear that you might have. It might mean doing the unpopular but correct thing. The term heroic is a synonym for bravery. And under the category of courage is persistence. We want to persevere to get to be unconsciously competent. And industriousness is important, finishing what you have started and keeping on despite obstacles to get to that joyous place of being unconsciously competent. When sustained activity results from an internal strength as opposed to threats or deadlines, it's highly engaging. And when the activity is complete, it produces significant satisfaction. Hopefully you've already had some of that satisfaction already during these 8 weeks, but I know it can be even greater as you incorporate the principles of this last program. Thomas Edison tried more than 6,000 substances before hitting on a carbonized cotton thread as a useful filament for the electric light bulb. What did he say? Genius is 99% what? Perspiration and 1% inspiration. Abraham Lincoln went through a lot of failures. He actually lost 6 elections, failed in 2 businesses. He lost his sweetheart that he was engaged to death, lost a child to death. And despite all of the challenges, perhaps one of our greatest presidents in moving the nation in the right direction despite all of the opposition that he faced. Integrity is also under courage. That means being truthful, even truthful in regards to your own thoughts. Taking responsibility for how you feel and what you do is part of integrity. And then also vitality comes under the character strength of courage, where you live your life with zest, enthusiasm, vigor, and energy, utilizing these new principles in a happy manner as you share them with the world. And this will also help you to feel good. Subjective feelings of engagement and satisfaction are part of the definition of vitality. So as we look at our whole 8-week theme in treatments for depression and anxiety, it's good to review at this point before we close these sessions. We need to attempt to find the cause. Review your DAT test. If your DAT test on the second session still shows that you have hits in those 7 categories that could be reversed, do your part and write that down and make sure you're working on that. So attempt to find the cause. Enhance your frontal lobe function in ways that we've been discussing here today. Avoid the frontal lobe suppressants, these addictive things that suppress it. Get adequate sleep. Get aerobic physical exercise or cardio exercise on a daily basis. Utilize hydrotherapy. That can even help us prevent depression and anxiety once we recover from it, the contrast baths. Practice those breathing exercises. Get healthy music as part of your regular routine at least once every 2 weeks, maybe even more often. Limit your screen time, and particularly no screen time an hour before going to bed, and avoid that negative thinking. Maybe you've gone through those 14 days without saying anything negative or critical, and I know if you have, it has helped you greatly. Practice cognitive behavioral therapy exercises. Actually, once you improve and get a transformed, renewed thought that's more accurate than your tendency for distorted thoughts, write that down. And then develop a 3x5 card list where you can go over that maybe a couple of times a day to remind yourself what's true. And that'll help develop new pathways in your brain. Increase your religiosity or spirituality. Increase reading and contemplating material with an ethical construct. That'll also help out. Choose relationships that can enhance and support this plan and others that might be on that same pathway of trying to improve their brain. And develop character traits to increase your positive, emotional, relational, and behavioral benefits. By the way, that increased reading and contemplating material and ethical construct, sometimes we call those devotions. And so having those daily devotions will also be helpful. We're told to watch our thoughts. Why? Because they become your words. Watch your words. Why? Because they become your actions. Watch your actions because they become your habits. And watch your habits because they become your character. And watch your character because it becomes your destiny. And I want to encourage each one of you to continue to work on each one of these things, because there is no doubt it will open the door to the great life, and you and the ones around you, your destiny will be very positively affected. Happiness comes from the interaction between inspiration and perspiration, we're told by a neuroscientist from New York. You've been inspired coming to these sessions, but it doesn't work if you're just inspired. You have to work the program. That means you have to perspire. Anything that stops humans from perspiring to achieve something inspiring, Braverman says, gives a false fantasy and an endless distraction from reaching your full potential. And I want you to reach your full potential. The amazing human brain that you have, that I have, is capable of changing for the better beyond what most people can even imagine. And you've gotten a great start with this 8-week course. Some of your scores have already significantly improved over these 8 weeks. Much better depression, anxiety, emotional intelligence scores. But remember, the plan is a full 20 weeks. If your scores didn't change that much, analyze if you truly participated in all of the elements and make a commitment to do so, because we have noticed the scores are very much related to how much you've engaged in all aspects of the program. And even if you engage in all aspects and you give it a good extra weeks and it's still not improving, there is still hope for you, because that means there's something that's undiagnosed. We know for sure that once we find the precise cause in you and can reverse that cause, you will get better. Everyone gets better when we reverse the particular causes that are there in depression and anxiety. It might take a residential program that we have. It might take some extra blood work. It might take some help with a particular therapist. And so I don't want you to get discouraged, but what you've already put into practice will continue to help you and will not be a hindrance. So in closing, I'm grateful that you have trusted me and our team to be part of your journey in depression and anxiety recovery. Each of you are of utmost importance, and I wish you all the best of body, mind, and soul. Thank you very much.